president might not come, and if he didn't, Bill realized he would upset my plans very much for the park dedication and for the birthday party, and he wanted me to know he was sorry. There was something about his tone that worried me far more than either presentation or party. He said he took the full blame, that it was all his fault, and what it is, I have no idea. But Bill contributes a certain quality of brilliance, of wit, and a mixture of aloofness from us with yet enough devotion to us that Linda needs, our organization needs. I could not bear to lose him. And his words about it may have hurt my relations with the president permanently fell like a stone on my heart. So the next thing to face was the arrival of Mr. Lennon and Hardy and family. I felt completely incapable of giving them the feeling of the importance of the occasion, the significance of the hour that Lyndon's presence would have lent, and completely determined when they arrived at the ranch in their plane, they would have all the warmth and courtesy and story of the ranch that I was capable of giving. That they were interested in this was evidenced by the fact that Mr. Lennon was bringing along his daughter, Margaret Lennon Dawson, and his sons, John and Whittington Lennon. It was nothing to do with uncertainty but to live through it and keep on with the business at hand, which was, in a few hours, to advance what could have been well advanced by professionals in days. I suggested to Bess announcement over the loudspeaker at the rodeo where the biggest crowd in Johnson City would certainly be gathered, that there would be a presentation of the Paw of a Park at 4:30, with Mrs. Johnson there, and the heads of Life and Time. Later on, we'd give him a flash about Lyndon if we got the word he was coming. To tell Jesse Hunter to get the word around at the Boyhood Home, that's the second largest crowd in Johnson City. And then she had to leave to find such necessary equipment as a platform and a microphone and notify Mayor George Byers. I gave up my prettiest red yucca plant from the front yard because the one we had bought from the nursery turned out to be bloomless. Pat Taylor planted it in a redwood tub, and leaning gracefully over the watercolor sketch of the park of the future, it should make an attractive picture. How marvelous that Bess remains serene in the midst of confusion and very peculiar demands. Bill Moyer was to call me back when he got any firm word. Someone did call to say that it was announced to the press about noon that he would leave within the hour, but it was 1:30 our time before we got the word that he was actually in the air. At 3, Mr. Lennon, head of all the Lifetime organization, and Mr. Hardy, president of Life itself, touched down, bringing with them the 3 Lennon children and a very attractive lady, Mrs. Fowler. Mr. Pitt had arrived earlier. We came in the living room, this time by the side door, not the kitchen, and Mary brought in a large tray of cold drinks and sandwiches and cookies. And then I suggested that perhaps they would like to see the house. Most certainly they would, and I made it as glowing as possible, trying to stay within my schedule. And then around over the ranch itself and the house where Lennon was born, the graveyard and the schoolhouse, with Jerry following to be my timekeeper and alert me 20 minutes before Lennon would land as planned at the Winter's Strip. It went like clockwork, and thank heavens I remembered enough to autograph copies of A President's Country to the 3 men and of A More Beautiful America for Mr. Lennon and Mr. Hardy, the only copies I had. To talk and listen at the same time is a difficult art, and almost everybody would rather tell some of their own experiences than listen without interruption. So I got treated to an hilarious tale about the time Life had the party, all of the people who had appeared on its cover during its days of publication. No doubt the most illustrious and varied guest list ever to be assembled. We arrived at Melvin Strip about 1 minute before helicopter number 1 settled on the ground, and Lyndon emerged like a whirlwind. I gave myself an A for remembering names, and then he got in with us. We drove to the park, and it was a sight to see. Our platform was the base of a float, bedecked with paper rosebuds. A band was playing in one corner, a motley crowd, half of whom I recognized as Johnson City folks, and about 12 or so of our birthday dinner guests, Federal Judge Homer Thornberry, all man and sometime Blancoite, Wesley West, the usual quota of tow-headed, barefooted boys. And I was suddenly struck with thinking how must this look to sophisticated people from New York. Pretty hopeless? With the backs of buildings that blatantly proclaim Fish 1961 and the worn-out refrigerators behind the hardware store. Well, come back in a year and we'll see. The 5 of us sat on the platform, Mayor Byers, Mr. Lennon, and Mr. Hardy, and Lyndon and I. Someone quickly got a chair for Linda Bird, and Lucy, as usual, managed to stand down in the crowd. Mr. Lennon made a very nice speech about life's 30 years dedication to improving the beauties of America, and how he wanted, on the occasion of the President's birthday, to express their appreciation for his beautification program, and also to their newest editor, a laughing allusion to me, and some nice words about the sensitivity and charm of my article, which I swallowed whole. The mayor had welcomed us first, and then I made my words of warm thanks, adding a little description of what the park was going to look like 1 year from now, and asked everyone to step up and see the watercolor renderings of the park, which Mr. Lennon gave me and we placed on an easel. And it was not until that moment that I had been sure Lyndon was going to say anything. He has a certain reluctance about this whole thing. Could he think it is because these people are laughing at his little hometown? He made an amusing, bucolic, reminiscent sort of speech about some little his memories of Johnson City, about two little boys who were having a fight in this very spot, and he, Lyndon, came along, aged about 6, and kicked them both over into the dust. And Olin Cox chased him all the way home. And then he told a story, an old but very good one, about Senator Wirt's defense of Maury Maverick, who had received money from David Dubinsky's union to buy poll taxes for the poor people in San Antonio. The evidence was so strong that the senator practically had to admit it. But he turned it all around the other way with the jury by talking about how the Yankees had always drained the South, drained Texas. And here this great patriot, this son of men who had fought at the Alamo and settled Texas, had actually gone up and brought some money down from the Yankees. And what did he do? Keep it for himself? No, he gave it to the poor folks of San Antonio. Well, Maury got off. And this was another instance, and told in a way that I think Lennon was only amused, in which those rich Yankees had come down and brought some money to Texas. Quickly, the ceremony was over. Lennon, I made my grateful goodbyes to Mr. Lennon and Mr. Hardy and Mrs. Fowler as we came down the steps from the float. Jumped in our car, and I'd planned for them to go up and see the boyhood home. The hurried word quickly gotten to Jesse Hunter to open it up. It was past 4. When Lennon called out, "Put them in! Bring them with us! Let's take them up to see the boyhood home!" We crowded in as many as could with Lennon at the wheel, and went up for what really proved a tour on roller skates, with Lennon in charge, and me giving as many thumbnail sketches to whatever interested straggler I could keep up with. And then I found ourselves out on the front porch, with Lyndon and Mr. Lennon seated in the swing, and the press and photographers swarming over the lawn. At that moment, a most delightful thing happened, the sort of thing that often happens to Lyndon, unplanned, unexpected. A small boy, not quite 2, I would say, in a red play suit, with a solemn, interested, amiable face, came walking up the steps, went over to Lyndon, put his hand on his leg, and looked up in his face. Lennon gathered him up and asked him to kiss him, which the little boy obliged by doing. And then Lennon began to try to give him a pencil. The little boy insisted on giving it back to him. It was a heyday for the photographers. Perfect little ham. I asked Liz to take care of them from then on, see that they got home, had drinks, any hospitality they wanted. Lyndon grabbed up Jesse Hunter as another guest for the birthday party, and we left in a swirl for the 2 helicopters at Melvin. Then the next hour, we all assembled at the Haywood by helicopter, car, from various points. The Morsons and Winters and West, Jesse Kellum, the Thornberries, Linda, Don Thomas's, the Billy Baileys, the Bill Heaths. Only later did I find that he had walked out on a dinner given in his honor by another member of the Board of Regents in Houston, chartered a plane, and flown up to join us. John and Nellie Conley. A little bit later, we were joined by Bess and Liz and Busby and Vicky and Marie and Jake. I took the less adventurous in the big boat, and Lyndon, leaving his cares on the bank, got in a speedboat. And it was then I saw the frailest little silver sliver of a new moon. How I liked the Indian method of counting time by the moons. It was 3 moons ago that I was in the Virgin Islands. We wound up at Mary Margaret's beach house, where Burge and Lucia and Becky were waiting for us. I'm so delighted to have them a part of Lyndon's life. And then coming back, most of us rode in the big boat. Some of the staff went back by car. It was the end of a tense day, and I was utterly ready for the top deck of the big boat, a pillow, a drink, good companions, the sunset and the new moon. As a birthday present, the press left us alone. John and Nellie were on the big boat coming back with us. He and Lyndon were talking about plans for John for the future, and John said he was not going to run again unless he changed his mind, that he would make his mind up within the next 3 weeks. Lyndon said, "You're crazy. Think what you can do for this state, and then maybe you could be vice president or president of this country." I wondered what sort of a forecast that meant for me and my plans for 68. I agree so wholeheartedly about John. He looks like Texas. He's the best of Texas, though too conservative sometime for me and Lyndon. With education, with tourism, with his youth and dynamism and tough intelligence, he's already done a lot for this state. He talked with excitement about a trip he'd made to see the DuPont laboratories, all their research. Much as he loves coastal Bermuda, I do not believe the ranch can contain him, and I do not believe it should. Nellie was happy, pretty, lively, flirting just a little bit with all the men, and everybody naturally gravitating to her. Back at the Haywood, we had a fish dinner. Unhappily, it had waited about an hour for us, because it was 9:30 before we sat down to eat, or closer to 10, maybe. And then, inside, the birthday cake and more coffee, with pictures first of a really wonderful cake, produced by Bessie's imagination, the White House kitchen's artistry, and some of my suggestions. On the top of it, "You can have your cake and eat it too," was lettered. And then, a little rolled-up scroll, a legislative bill, certainly, and a hypodermic needle, and that represented Medicare. And another place, some tiny modern houses, and another rolled-up scroll. Housing. Trucks and roadway building represented Appalachia. Major achievements all over the cake. And then the presents. There were some paintings, a wonderful one of horses hitched out in front, what looked like an old stagecoach inn, the light coming out of the window that you could almost see by. Delightful pictures of Linda Bird on her western trip, one holding up a bite for a little chipmunk who was standing within a foot of her on his hind legs, eagerly awaiting the bite. Hilarious one from Bess, a framed poster, circa 1890 or 1900, I suppose, entitled "The Management," informing the employees that they would show up at work at 6:30 in the morning, sweep out the store, get the fire started, and a few more such duties that went on until 9 o'clock at night, including some advice about their social life in between. Very prim, it must be, what there was of it. And my own gifts, the one I liked best, an album about Lyndon's father's life in the Texas legislature, including a very well-done copy, the Alamo Purchase Bill, which he passed, and some amusing photostats of newspaper articles about his service in the legislature, particularly that during the war years from 1917-18. Another, the history of this house, the ranch house, which Liz had so diligently researched, begun about 1892, with wonderful pictures ranging from 1893 to 1965. Vast boxes of ties from Wesley, a gargantuan box of candy, the best in the world, but enough to put on 5 pounds on each member of us assembled. It was a good evening with very special friends. So wonderful to see Homer and Eloise, happy, relieved, out from under the sword of Damocles. Lucy and Pat and Helene joined us, and the hit of the evening was the poem Lucy had composed for her daddy's birthday about On Becoming 57. Her philosophy, her relations with him. A combination of perception and wisdom and laughter. It was very appealing to all of us. Linda is so sterling, so companionable, so dear. But at this moment in our lives, Lucy has the knack for stealing the spotlight. It was not ever thus. It used to be Linda and will again. It was after 12:30 when we got home, and probably 2 before we went to sleep. But whatever the strains and tensions and distresses of the day in Washington may have been, they were not noticeable in Linda's manner. He was like a man riding on a crest of achievement and success, and he was also a happy and relaxed man. I shall remember his 57th birthday with happiness.